From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Now, the traffickers, these are people that take drugs. These are guys of the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, these type of guys that come from Connecticut, New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, then they go back home.
You know, I'm a father of three kids. I love fireworks, but there's no question that we couldn't bear that cost at a time when we're doing so many other things that are very, very difficult.
I'm committed to the city. I'm committed to playing baseball here. And in that vein, submitted a proposal to complete the ballpark.
Did you say everlasting gobstoppers?
That's right. For children with very little pocket money, you can suck them forever.
I want an everlasting gobstopper.
Me too.
And me.
Fantastic invention. Revolutionized the industry. You can suck them and suck them and suck them, and they'll never get any smaller. Never. At least I don't think they do. A few more tests.
That's some of the news of the week out of context here in The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks so much for joining us today. You can, as always, join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe is away this week, so playing the part of Colin McEnroe is Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Hello there, Danny.
Insert snarky remark here.
There'll be plenty of time for that. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Hi there, Paz.
Good morning, John.
And Suzanne Bates is here as well, Policy Director at the Yankee Institute. Hello once again, Suzanne.
Good morning.
We're also joined by the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network. We're going to start in the city of Hartford in kind of a dire situation. We'll get to the stadium stuff in a bit, but Mayor Luke Bronin's been making some tough decisions, layoffs, canceling fireworks, as we heard, even approaching the state and surrounding towns asking for help. Dan, I'll start with you. Is there a possibility that Hartford's just going to go bankrupt?
Well, there's a very strong possibility that Hartford's going to file for bankruptcy protection. Whether it files for protection or not, the problems remain the same, and the solutions are more or less going to have to be negotiated financial solutions, whether in a court or in the state legislature or in town halls surrounding Hartford.
Town halls surrounding Hartford is one of the things we want to get to a little bit, Paz. I mean, what does this mean at the state level when you have the capital city not just falling on hard times, but seemingly in a hole that it's going to have a hard time getting out of?
This comes, of course, at the worst possible time. If this happened 10 years ago or so, there would be a serious effort at the Capitol, I believe, to really look at property tax reform, to look at revamping the payments in lieu of taxes that cities like Hartford, where half its property is tax exempt or otherwise unavailable for taxes. But right now, the state is in its own crisis. So this, you know, this is a, you know, typically as a reporter watching these things, you have a good idea of what will unfold. I have no idea how this one ends.
Well, yeah, the state's in its own crisis, but I guess I just wonder how much of the state's crisis is the city of Hartford's crisis. I mean, the city relies on money from the state. One of the things the state has to do that has dug its own hole is bail out cities and towns, spread some money around. I mean, the problems are interlinked.
I rarely promote our own site on the show, but I will do so now. Tom Condon has a very good explanation of the underpinnings of the financial problems facing Hartford and Bridgeport. So if you want to look at ctmirror.org, it's a piece that will make it harder to just say, oh, Hartford is mismanaged. You know, there are things that, yes, do stem from some bad choices, primarily with pension benefits, which is a familiar story in the public sector.
But that doesn't happen at the state level at all.
But it goes far deeper than that.
Yep.
And in fact, the reason that the wolf has not been at the door before this is Hartford actually has a history of some pretty good financial management, particularly when it came to pensions. Unfortunately, over the last maybe 10, 15 years, that kind of got eroded. But the reason Hartford did not have the crisis that Bridgeport had in the early 90s is that Hartford's pension fund generally was fully funded. But now the liabilities are overcoming the ability to pay, as Luke Brown and the mayor has recently said, you know, he could eliminate the entire police department and some other major departments, and it still would not balance the budget.
And that doesn't sound good. Suzanne?
So it's interesting. The state has to give permission to municipalities if they want to declare bankruptcy. So before Hartford could declare bankruptcy, they would have to go to the state and ask for permission. And I, you know, kind of dug into the books a little bit to look and see where Hartford's problem's coming from. They do have some retiree and pension debt issues, but the biggest thing was bonded debt. Their bonded debt is out of control, and they've pushed off debt service so much that, you know, the debt service payments are growing exponentially in that budget. So Mayor Bronin does have some problems, and he also has a punishingly high property tax for commercial property. Residential property is treated differently in Hartford. They have lower property taxes, people who live in Hartford, than businesses do. So you really haven't seen substantial private investment in the city in years. So there are a lot of, you know, just systemic problems here.
I want to hear from actually Luke Ronan here. Here's an interview that he did with the Hartford Courant just a couple days ago.
We're not asking anyone to pay for inefficiency. We're not asking anyone to subsidize waste or make our decisions easier. We are very ready to make hard decisions that need to be made to get the city on track. But here's the basic structural problem. You've got a city with real city challenges that is asked to run government operations based on the property tax when we have barely more property than the town of Farmington and less taxable property than the town of West Hartford. That's a structural problem that goes beyond what can be fixed in Hartford City Hall. It's something we as a region and as a state need to recognize if we're going to get this state and this region on the path to growth.
Well, you know, the best way to look at this bankruptcy situation is not whether Hartford slides into a bankruptcy. Hartford is insolvent right now. Hartford is insolvent. So Hartford could go to court. Hartford can go to the state legislature. Hartford needs to look at its bonded debt. I agree with Suzanne. It may be the last time today that we agree. I think that another factor in this is that we're seeing a long-term secular change in distribution of income, which leaves places like West Hartford divided within themselves, rich and poor. Hartford doesn't have any upper middle class neighborhoods beside the West End, the north end of the West End. And so the distribution curve that changes for the whole state and nation affects Hartford only in one direction. And that's aside from the bonded debt that's happened, much of which has been for legitimate things, baseball stadiums notwithstanding, for the purpose of getting money back to Hartford. But there are a lot of factors, and distribution of income across the country is one of them.
Well, I mean, the baseball stadium is a headline version of what cities do, sometimes very, very badly. But cities have things like ballparks because they're expected to be the centers of gravity for entire regions. So it's not just a ballpark that might be the place where people come and spend a couple dollars, buy a beer, and entertain the family. But it's also things like, as Paz said, hospitals and government buildings. It's not just that it's non-taxable property, Dan, but you know, Hartford's the place that's expected to put on the big fireworks display. And Hartford is kind of on the hook for a region. When Luke Bronin says, I need help from the Farmingtons and the Glastonburys and the West Hartfords, what should they say?
Well, for the fireworks, there should have been a regional solution. They were only about $18,000 short for a show that would have been worth a whole lot more than that. But as far as the comparing the stadium to things like hospitals, the issue here is that Hartford stepped up and paid for the stadium. I can think of no jurisdiction as small and poor as Hartford in the country that has built a stadium, because they're regional. They are regional. I hate this word asset, but assets. They're regional stadium. Stadia. So they only – the stadium, if it spins off any money, it doesn't spin off any direct money, of course. We know that. If it creates development and jobs, that helps the region more than it helps the city. So it was a stupid error for the city to agree to finance a stadium. But that's only symbolic. That's $4 million a year in a $560 million budget. It doesn't help, but that's not the reason Hartford is in trouble.
One of my great joys in life is watching Danny debate himself over word choices in mid sentence,
just live on radio.
Live on radio. Hartford's problems are so complicated and so intertwined. And as somebody who covered the city twice in two different times, I will admit I I react very badly when you have this simplistic bashing of the city. Not that Danny's doing that and not that Suzanne is doing that, but you do hear that. There is this incredible ignorance of all the factors that go into the financial crisis that Hartford is facing. To Suzanne's point, you know, problem when your financial problems are driven by bonded debt, when it's driven by pension obligations, that's huge because there's no simple solution. It's not like you cut the budget once. It's what Connecticut is facing now. Connecticut is facing a problem that was 30, 40 years in the making. You can't make it go away even if everybody agrees we're going to do the right thing, whatever that may be.
But the thing is, though, a state, Suzanne, has a lot more levers that it can pull to try to get out of that hole. There are a lot of ways that state government can work and that city government just can't. I mean, the city of Hartford seems to be stuck at the door with the state asking for help because there's no other place to get it. I don't know how a city like Hartford, and not just Hartford, but like Hartford, gets out of the mess that it's in.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you know, Governor Malloy, when we were talking about Hartford's problems a couple months ago, Governor Malloy said, you know, we give Hartford half its budget already, which is true. So it's not like the Hartford's left alone, right? It already is getting money from the suburbs through a transfer of the income tax. But, you know, it was Mayor Bronin came to the legislature this past session and asked for help. Essentially, what he wanted was a workaround around binding arbitration. He wanted to be able to get into those union contracts and change some of the work rules and some of the benefits that are really, you know, making city employees very expensive. And the legislature just kind of tossed him out and said, no, thanks. You know, right after they had a big press conference with the unions and said, we're not going to agree to this.
But to Paz's earlier point, but even if you got rid of a huge number of those workers, if you got rid of the entire police force, it wouldn't solve the problem. So it's almost like nibbling around at the edges around an issue that truly can't be solved just by maybe collectively bargaining down a slightly better deal for some city workers.
Sure. I think there are some really substantial changes they can make, like to retiree health care. That's a huge liability on the city's books right now. There are things you can do. They are painful things. These are not easy things, and these are painful things, and the unions would not agree to them. And so, you know, he's having a hard time getting them to give back $15 million, which he's looking for in this year's budget. So, you know, he's asked the state for help, and the state has kind of turned him away. So,
well, I mean, it was startling when he came in and asked for that right off the bat. And, you know, I think the case needs to be made, and I think it is being made. And the question, you know, you have a little bit of a game of chicken. You know, I don't think anybody wants the state capital of one of the richest states in the nation to be in Chapter 9. But you know, there are other things they can do as well. I mean, Bronin right now, when they do layoffs, you don't really get efficiencies because of work rules. You know, municipal workforces in big cities are broken up into these units, and you can't move people around. And, you know, it may be time for the public sector labor unions to say, look, we got to give management flexibility. We got to fight like hell to protect our workers' jobs and their, you know, wages and benefits to the extent it's possible. But you got to give some flexibility. And that's one of the things that even when cities do layoffs, they quite often end up with government that ceases to function because they can't move the remaining workers around where they're needed most.
I have to say that we've skirted around this a little bit, but it is something we've talked about an awful lot on the show. I mean, all of these problems in the city, it doesn't really take into account the fact that we've got this half-finished baseball stadium. The owner of the team, Josh Solomon, recently said he was going to offer up money to finish the stadium. The mayor said no. The job of paying to finish the stadium falls on the insurance company backing the former developer, and then he would like to protect Hartford taxpayers. Let's listen to Luke Bronin again.
This is a project that the prior administration began, and all told, the costs already outlaid are going to be approaching $100 million. Obviously, the developers went over budget and far behind schedule as far back as January. But the bulk of the costs that bring the stadium so high above what was told to the public are the fact that the prior administration simply agreed to pay on the quiet for all of these roadwork improvements that cost tens of millions of dollars.
Dan, you know, with everything else that we're talking about here, you know, as Colin McEnroe has said often, we agreed to pay for a $60 million stadium, which is far more than a city of its kind would normally pay for, and far more than is normally spent for a ballpark of this type and size for minor league baseball. Now it's going to be $100 million, and the league that the Hartford Yard Goats, I guess they're the Hartford Yard Goats, they've not played a game in Hartford yet, play in, has essentially said, if you can't get this fixed soon, you won't even have a baseball stadium, a team. You'll have a stadium with nobody to play in it.
Well, first of all, they will play baseball on April 13th because they're so close that no one has – everyone has a huge incentive, including the insurance company, to get this done.
I'm
and so,
putting money on the table
right now. Yeah, there will be baseball. There will be baseball, and maybe Pedro Segura had his chance to throw out the first pitch this year, and maybe Luke Brohner will be forced – to throw out the first pitch in 2017, but there will be baseball. Looking at the breakdown of the cost, the $100 or $102 million, whatever it was, much of that, about $40 million of that is – or about 30-some million of that is cost associated with Dono, which have nothing to do with the stadium.
And again, Dono is the downtown development, which was supposed to have all sorts of other stuff beyond a ballpark.
The adjacent development. And I should add that the first buildings in Dono were supposed to start opening in 2017, and that, of course, does not appear that that will happen, although anything is possible. I guess that isn't possible. I'm debating.
It's not possible.
Not possible. Okay. Mark says it's not.
unless they're tents.
But the big cost that was hidden by the city was site work. And that was $11 million, more or less. And we were writing about that at the Hartford Current and the Mirror, for that matter. We were all writing about that at the time. Nobody would listen. And so part of it is that the city was being secretive, and part of it was that the process itself was skewed because it was, as we saw, a done deal to begin with. So there was a whole it's more than just saying the costs weren't all accounted for. It was the whole way the process was done. But that's all done in the past, and we're going to have baseball, and the baseball stadium is not the biggest part of Hartford's problems right now. It's a symbol.
It's a symbol. It seems like a pretty potent symbol. I think Danny Haar is going to get to throw out the first pitch of the new ballpark. He's the first person who's this optimistic that we're actually going to have baseball in April. But anyway, Paz?
To me, this will be resolved based on one question, and I don't know the answer. I don't know enough about surety law. But if the surety company is on the hook for consequential damages of this thing not being built on time, in other words, if they lose their prime tenant – and then they have this asset of $60 million, $100 million, whatever, that they are paying revenue bond debt on, and they lose their tenant. If the surety company's on the hook for that, then I'm with Danny. This will get settled because there is a huge incentive to make this thing work. They are very close to getting it done, and the consequences of not getting it done are disastrous on all sides.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, I mean, the baseball stadium is symbolic of something. There's this inner crumbling that's going on in Hartford. And, you know, we kind of talk about bankruptcy. It's happened in a few big cities now, so it doesn't seem like a big deal. But there's a real human cost. You know, pensions get tinkered with. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are going to happen if the city goes into bankruptcy. So whatever we can do, you know, before that happens to try to solve some of these problems, I think is going to be critical.
Suzanne Bates is policy director of the Yankee Institute. Mark Pazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Danny Haar writes for the Hartford Current. When we come back, we've often teased our state's governor for being prickly. So we'll ask this fill-in-the-blank question. If Dan Malloy is a porcupine, then Maine Governor Paula Page is? You can fill in that blank on the Wheelhouse right after this. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're taking a look at some of the week's news with Dan Haar from the Hartford Current, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute. Join us at 860-275-7266. We've been hearing back and forth about whether Maine Governor Paul LePage is going to resign. He's made headlines over the years for colorful language and controversial views. Just last week, he left a threatening message on the voicemail of a Democratic lawmaker who said who LePage said called him a racist. This week, he again linked blacks and Hispanics to the heroin epidemic in his state. Here he is in a video from the Portland Press-Herald.
If I am a racist for trying to get black people and Hispanic people and white people and Asian people who come up to 95 with heroin that will kill Mainers, then I plead guilty. I do plead guilty.
Of course, he did this the week before a big conference of governors and premiers from the eastern part of Canada. Governor Molloy was at that meeting. He was asked to respond to some of LePage's comments that included continued conversation about people coming from Waterbury, Connecticut to sell drugs to Mainers.
I think it is a great disservice to look at this as a racial issue. It is not. It should not be confused as one. And we need to be careful about not mixing race into this particular issue.
A very measured Governor Molloy there, Paz, talking in Boston at this meeting of governors and Eastern Canadian premiers. First of all, I guess I'm just wondering what you make of a politician like Paul LePage and where he stands right now. He's talked about resigning, and then he's backed off resigning. He said just the other day on a radio station that he was going to apologize to the lawmaker that he left a threatening message to, but he did not want to apologize for some of the things that he said about people of color selling drugs in Maine. He also said during this interview, this is on him being called a racist, he says, it's like calling a black man the N-word or a woman the C-word, he said. It just absolutely knocked me off my feet. No, Governor LePage, that's actually not what it's like at all, but I'll let you continue, Paz.
Well, I'm trying not to adopt the stance of somebody holding a gun and pointing it at a barrel full of fish because Governor LePage is easy pickings. I want to go to the heart of, I think, LePage's reliance on race in talking about heroin being a problem brought by outsiders. You know, there are times when I will applaud a public official who will confront very sensitive issues that involve race and cultural differences when they are relevant to a problem. But LePage has yet to explain the relevance of the race of people bringing heroin into Maine. Yes, heroin is brought to Maine by outsiders. There are no poppy fields in Maine, just as there are no poppy fields in Waterbury, Connecticut. These are transshipment points. So even if LePage is correct about the racial background of these folks, the big question is, so what? What does it say about the drug trade as opposed to what does it say about Governor LePage? And whether or not his statistics are correct, he insists that 90% of the drug traffickers arrested for dealing heroin in Maine are black and Hispanic from places like Waterbury, Connecticut, the Bronx, in Brooklyn, and now he's added Lawrence and Lowell, Mass. To his list of shame. The statistics which the governor, Governor Molloy, repeated at the conference suggest otherwise, that there are 421 people doing time in Maine on drug trafficking charges. More than 300 of them are white. Now, LePage's answer is, yeah, but they're all meth heads. It's the heroin guys are still black.
Meth is a white problem. The other problem—
well, but again, okay, what difference does it make? Because it does not inform your enforcement strategies. It does not inform your interdiction strategies and your treatment strategies.
But I think to take a little bit closer look at it, what he does seem to be saying, though, is it does inform his enforcement strategies in that— in one of his tirades, Paz, he continually said that the enemy, essentially, is those people coming from the outside selling those drugs, and one might point guns at the enemy.
That was blatant racial profiling.
There's a huge question here about whether or not he just sees people of color as the enemy. And that's a problem, Suzanne, for the people of Maine. It's the problem for, I mean, I cover a whole region, New England now, as part of my new job. We are all very interconnected and we are all very close to one another. And the fact that the governor of one of the states talks like this seems to me to be troubling to people of color all across our great region.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that, you know, the governor was right, which I will not say frequently, but, you know, Governor Molloy was right this is not about race. I mean, when we're talking about some really serious problems with heroin addiction, it should not be about race. It was interesting, though. I was speaking to a friend recently who lives in Maine and who actually knows Governor LePage. And I kind of said, what's up with your governor? You know, I didn't know his background. Apparently, he was homeless from 11 until he was 18. Grew up in a house where he was abused by an alcoholic dad. Only spoke French until he went off to college. I mean, it doesn't excuse his behavior. It explains kind of the rough style a little bit. And I think that that's why people have been a little more patient with him up till now. But it seems like, you know, this latest news that he might be thinking about resigning because his own party has said enough. You can't say these things. It's not right, which is good. They should be saying that. But I think that that explains why there's been some patience with him up until now. This history, again, it doesn't excuse his behavior, but it kind of explains a little bit.
You know, there's a name we're not using during this show. But he's a guy. He's a good guy, a world-class guy. He's gonna do big things. And this type of behavior expressed by that person whose name we're not mentioning today is giving cover to these numbskulls across the country. This would 5 years ago, even 2 years ago, this guy would have been out of office today, right? But because the tenor of the politics of outrage has become so much a part of it's part of celebrity culture. It's part of everything is seen as this has got to be a big outrageous thing. You know, you can't sell policy news anymore like the stuff we're talking about. You have a great audience here. But it's become
we can't sell policy news. The Connecticut Mirror is shutting down tomorrow.
Serious discussion.
Don't even joke.
We're not getting into the business of any of our businesses at
exactly.
all here. But serious discussion about policy is becoming more of a boutique item, and the politics of outrage is becoming the mainstream. The very fact that we're talking about this numbskull in serious terms tells us that the discourse has broken. And again, there's a guy in the middle of it who's both a symbol and a driver.
Okay. We're talking about it in serious terms, in part, though, Susan, because this week he's sitting at a table with the other governors and Eastern Canadian premiers talking about energy policy, talking about whether or not we're going to expand the production of hydropower coming down from Quebec, whether or not we're going to take on enormous investments in renewable energy that will take place in large part in states like his up north and filter down to states like ours. I mean, this is actually a really very serious time to have a serious person having these serious conversations, not someone who is threatening people and leaving voicemail messages with words I can't even say anywhere near the radio, let alone on the radio.
Sure, which is why I think his party is finally saying enough, right? And I think that he hasn't been, you know, awful in all areas, which is why there has been some patience with him, you know, up until now. But you know, I mean, there was some allusion to maybe he's having a substance abuse problem. Who knows? You know, there's something going on behind the scenes here. And people are pushing back.
This is a situation where the fact that there's a back and forth in a discourse and that this guy is not out on his ear, gone, kaput,
here's the thing,
gone,
though,
is amazing to me.
I think because, and it's some of the outrage, but it's also this pushback on this politically correct culture, which I think people are kind of sick of. You know, you can't say anything without
being
called a name anymore.
That's the biggest bunch of nonsense in the entire American
no,
discourse.
It isn't.
The idea that you can say racist and classist and nationalist things in the name of speaking your mind to me is just an absolute outrage in and of itself. It's ridiculous. It is bringing down the discourse.
Far.
It is absolute nonsense. It's not about policy. And it
all
should
right.
stop. And
talk look, about outrage.
And we're talking
Dan
over.
Hey, John, what's up?
We're
you
want to
go out for coffee?
We're talking over each other just like we're on some AM talk radio station.
That was
this
a simulation.
Is, believe it or not, the wheelhouse. And we're talking today with Susan Bates from the Yankees, to Dan Harp from the Hartford Current, and our own Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Hey, we're going to turn to maybe some legislative issues that we may be talking about a little bit. I want to talk about something that I don't know, but because I'm going
to
let Susan cool down just a little bit before we talk about the income tax.
Why does the conservative always get called angry?
I'm just teasing. Let's talk about some of the issues that are going to come up in this legislative session, Paz, that maybe are actually going to mean something during this upcoming election cycle. We've got, of course, all the seats in the legislature up for grabs. There's an awful lot at the state level that we need to grapple with. I mean, what are some of the big issues you see coming up that are maybe going to affect the elections coming up for the legislature and then this next legislative session?
The confidence of the current government. I mean, that's how the Republicans are trying desperately to frame this. They're trying, even though Governor Malloy is not on the ballot, they're trying to tie state government up with one neat little bow and say, look, do you like what you have? You have a Democratic legislature. You have a Democratic governor. isn't it time for something different? And that, in a nutshell, is the debate statewide in different districts, depending on the demographics. Yes, you have different issues here and there. There are certain districts where very liberal issues play, such as $15 an hour minimum wage. But, you know, the state, to use that tired expression, the state generally does seem to be at something of a crossroads politically. You have CBIA, the state's largest business organization, for the first time really trying to nudge some of these races. They're spending more than $400,000 on independent expenditures on some targeted races. They claim it's a coincidence that they've targeted four state Senate races. Of course, four is the magic number. If Republicans pick up four seats, they have a 19-17 majority. So, you know, I think under pressure from their own membership, CBIA is trying to do that. On the other hand, you have the working families that did pretty well in some of the Democratic primaries. You had a very liberal candidate win Brendan Sharkey's old seat or the seat he holds now. He's not running for reelection. And there's a lot of speculation that even this guy, Josh Elliott, even his entrance in the race was one of the factors that nudged Brendan Sharkey, the House Speaker, into retirement.
Suzanne, I mean, what do you see as some of the big issues that are coming up, both for the election cycle and then as we head into this next legislative session?
Well, it's interesting because it's not just Governor Malloy that's super unpopular. When you look at the polling numbers, the legislature itself is also very unpopular. But, you know, as we all know—
Same number, in fact, 24%.
That's right. But as we all know, that doesn't translate down to sometimes you cannot like the body, but you like your own individual member. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But I think what I'm not hearing a lot of are solutions. We have this huge looming deficit coming up in our next session that they're going to have to deal with. You know, who's going to raise taxes? Who's going to offer more cuts? What are the solutions? I haven't heard that from either party.
And you won't.
This session.
You won't.
And I'm so
campaign.
Frustrated with that. I think we all need to push them. There are solutions. There are. But they're hard solutions.
So,
we're going to have to get to the end of
well,
it.
Before
well,
we
that's why you won't hear them, because they are hard. And there's no political percentage in saying I'm for these tax increases and those service cuts. I mean, that's just politics 101, unfortunately.
Quickly, turn to a solution before I throw it over to Danny. I mean, what's one solution that you hope could be implemented or at least talked about as we head into the election and, of course, into the next session?
Well, there are like 20 state employee contracts that are open that are going to be voted on. Or not. I mean, they don't have to vote on them, actually, in this next legislative session. What are they going to do with those contracts? And because that has a huge impact on our state budget. So I think there's something that they could be talking about. There's a real difference on the Democratic and the Republican side. But they don't. I think you're right, Mark. I think that they don't want to talk about these things because it's a really difficult thing. But I think we should all be pushing them to talk about what they're going to do.
Actually, the 30 state contracts that are in negotiation now and that are operating under expired contracts, let's start with the idea that they're going to be voted on, because there is no agreement that they're going to be voted on. Right now, they don't have to be voted on, and they should be. I agree with the side that says that, and that would be you as well. So we're in agreement on that. One of the odd things that's happening here is that one of the solutions is to slow the rate of state spending increases. You can't reverse it because of health costs and pension costs, but you can slow the rate of health of state increases. And under this administration, for all of its unpopularity and for all of its 2 years of very large tax increases, rate of spending has gone from about 5% and change under the prior two administrations, which was really one administration, to 2.9% a year. And actually, that would be adjusted down because this year was closer to zero. And so it's a slow and long process. And so the Republicans who are running against the Democrats are still in many cases, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, running against spending, even though the spending curve has actually already turned. And so it's an awkward position because they're running against something that has, in a sense, already been addressed as much as it can be within the confines of mandated requirements.
They're also, in some cases, running against some of the spending cuts. They've objected very sharply to the hospital cuts. They've objected to many of the choices the Malloy administration has made. And let's be honest, you know, these are lousy choices you're facing when, you know, you're going to privatize group homes for the intellectually disabled, when you're going to eliminate aftercare programs for when they age out at a certain point. These are things that are imposing significant hardships on Connecticut families. Nobody likes it. But yeah, I mean, so there again, every time the administration puts something forward, you get more people shooting at it than you do applauding it.
Yeah.
And I think what Republicans are saying is let's get at the things that are really driving the growth and get at some of these systemic problems instead of dealing, you know, making these whacks, you know, that nobody likes.
But if every contract has a 0% increase, let's say they do that. And let's say either that's what comes out of the negotiation or, I mean, binding ARB, and then the legislature can endlessly send it back.
It still doesn't fix the problem.
Well, exactly.
But there are other municipalities. For example, I met recently with the mayor of San Jose. He gave everyone a 3% pay cut when they were facing a similar problem. I mean, maybe that needs to be on the table. You know, so because we can't get at the benefits, which are really driving the cost of each state employee until 2022, like, but we can talk about salaries because those are open this year. Then maybe we need to look at pay cuts again. None of these things are great. None of these solutions are, you know, we love this solution, but we have to deal with this.
The problem is that the problem exists in the past. The benefits that exist now for the latest tier of employees hired since 2011 are still better than those of the private sector and certainly those of the media sector. But is there a media sector? Combined with the fact that the typical state employee with a college degree earns slightly less than he or she would earn in the private sector, it more or less evens out. Yes, it's still rich, and yes, it needs to be adjusted a little bit, but there isn't a massive fix that's going to be had from the current employees. It has to do with the past employees and the benefits that are being paid out, combined with bureaucracy that existed that they're trying to unwind.
Let me push
that you can't.
Back on that just a little, because actually in Connecticut, salaries of public employees are the same as private employees when you compare people with similar experience and education. So in most states, public employees are paid less. And I know you're talking about the pensions. Tier one pensions, which are much more generous than the latest pensions. But we still have retiree health care, which is actually one of our biggest liabilities and one of the biggest, fastest growing benefits. And that remains the same.
Well, and
so
what are
people who retire, you know, at 55, 60.
Yeah, that's $700 million a
year. It's a huge cost.
Yes, you
know.
And one of the reforms that Governor Rell and then Governor Malloy have made, they have steadily nudged upward the age at which you can retire. And, of course, one of the reasons that's so important, for every year younger than 65 that somebody retires, they're getting full state health benefits when they retire, as opposed to when they hit 65, the state benefits become supplemental to Medicare. And that's why this governor has always said state employees don't even dream of early retirement incentives, because that just exacerbates the problem that Suzanne outlined.
Yeah, I just want to turn quickly before we have to break to one seemingly small little issue, but it's the sort of thing that can tie up a legislature in talking about. It's the issue of, ready for this, Dan? Minimum bottle pricing.
Oh,
for some reason, we have a minimum price for, say, a bottle of liquor that you'd buy in Connecticut. It's something that doesn't exist in other states. Why do we have this?
So Dan? Does this have to do with those little minimum bottles?
No,
that you buy?
Not the minimum bottles. The ones that you get at the bottle store. I'm talking about the big bottle.
Yeah, this is an amazing issue because it's rare. I can't recall an example where we've seen two big retailers, just simply openly, not only openly flouting the law, but advertising, paying money to advertise the fact that they're openly violating the law. And Jonathan Harris, the Commissioner of Consumer Protection, who oversees liquor sales, has said he's investigating. But that investigation better take place awfully quickly because people are angry. Carol Hughes, the lobbyist, says yesterday, shut these places down. He's probably going to win the battle and lose the war.
Okay, and again, the lobbyists, we're talking about this existing PAS because there's this lobby for small liquor retailers that has wanted to impose a minimum bottle price. They say that they'll be crowded out of the market by big retailers coming in. This exists. It sounds to me, from what I read from the governor, even though, again, these companies are flouting the law, as Danny says, that the governor isn't quite sure why we have a law like this. He's been trying to change it. I mean, I don't know exactly what happens here, but it is an unusual circumstance, certainly.
I asked the governor yesterday, in fact, aren't you inviting a subpoena for a deposition from these two chains?
And he said,
to explain why this law is wrong. And he's, well, I won't say exactly what he said initially. Look, this is an outgrowth of history. The liquor industry, the retail liquor industry, is the last of the super regulated businesses. The blue laws survived here the longest, right? You couldn't buy beer and wine and hard liquor on Sundays until recently. You had to do your shopping by 8 p.m. So this was – Carol Hughes, who's the lobbyist for the package store owners, has done a phenomenal job for 30 years of protecting these small merchants against the competition of larger retailers. But they are here. They have a beachhead, these two companies. The package stores that will survive are the ones who are upping their game, who are doing tasting bars, who are offering services, who are offering greater variety, all that stuff. And, you know, so I think Danny's right. Over the long term, they're going to – the small guys are going to lose. The package stores are the hole-in-the-wall places that have been getting by for years because they're propped up by anti-competitive laws are going
to
die.
Well, and I just have to say this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, Suzanne. You know, my local hardware store is a small family-run, know the guy who runs it, and I willingly go in there and pay more for a wrench than going down to Home Depot because I know it's going to him. And I also know that I'll have someone there who can help me with my purchase. The difference is it's not like the wrench has to be a certain price so that he can sell it at the same price as the Home Depot. There's something about this that sounds so completely confounding. I'll still go to my local liquor store because they help me pick out wine. But I don't even know how this still exists in Connecticut today.
It's just, you know, like you said, it's a sort of historic problem. But it's interesting. Actually, Governor Mulley reached out to us at the Yankee Institute and asked us to weigh in on this subject last session because, you know, we are opposed to a lot of these government regulations.
Was that the first
one.
Time this has ever happened?
It was pretty shocking, I think, for everyone involved. But, you know, we happily spoke up about it.
Kind of exciting.
I think, but it's funny, when you peel back the layers on a lot of these government regulations, they are put in place by other entities that are trying to crowd out, you know, competition. So, I mean, that's true about a lot of regulations. There are a lot of regulations out there that businesses have put in place to say, you know, keep this field free for us.
I think we all agree that the change is coming, but it doesn't make the world a better place.
It doesn't make
that change that is coming and it can't be stopped doesn't make the world a better place. The world is a better place when people are paying a little bit more and having a little bit more of a human interaction in all of their transactions.
Is it a better place when you are forced to do that as opposed to choose to do that, as my earlier metaphor sort of suggested, that you choose to go to a boutique because it's going to provide better service as opposed to being forced to pay that higher price?
Well, you're throwing a wrench into the question, but the fact that it makes no sense to force those prices is the reason that the Liquor Association is going to lose this war. The immediate point right now is that these two retailers can't be allowed to do what they're doing for now.
We've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to spend a little time talking about somebody from Connecticut who certainly did make the world a better place, Gene Wilder. We're also going to go back out on the road. Danny Haar walked across Connecticut once. He spent some time walking with Chris Murphy. We'll turn to those stories next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Today in The Wheelhouse, Suzanne Bass joins us from the Yankee Institute, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Dan Haar from the Hartford Current. Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy's taken a page from Dan Haar's book. He's walking across the state in his standard-issue cargo shorts, don't you know, talking to constituents, holding town halls. From his Twitter feed, we can see he's been visiting a lot of farms. Here he is at the start of his walk.
We're in Voluntown, Connecticut, right next to the Sunny's Market in front of Town Hall, and I'm about to start walking across the state of Connecticut. I don't know how far I'm going to get. I'm going to try to do about 12 miles today. The idea is to try to, you know, be in touch with the people that I represent here in the state in a different way. I'm going to try to meet as many people as I can, people that might never call my office on their own. They might talk to me as I walk by their business or their home or their church. We're going to see how this goes.
All right, Dan, so you spent some time walking with him here. I mean, what's the senator trying to do?
Well, the first 5 miles I was with him, it was a great bit of nostalgia for me. It wasn't the same road that I walked, but it was the same style of walking.
One foot after another?
In cargo, two guys in cargo shorts, I might add. I applaud what he's doing. He's going out and just being in the state. And it's not that he's trying to hear about issues even. It's not that he simply wants to see the state in a different way. And there was a couple of tweets that were tweeted out, why don't you get back to work on solving Connecticut's problems and this kind of thing. And to me, this is the core of solving Connecticut's problems. I also applaud the senator because he didn't make it into a big media event. You know, he called me. I had done the walk, and I don't know if other reporters have been out there, but he wasn't pushing for that at all. And so it's a matter of stopping and talking with people for 2 or 3 minutes. I might add that yesterday he did 29 miles, which
is pretty good.
I think that's 2 times longer than my longest day. It's a long way to walk, and you're stopping and talking with people and tweeting, and it's just being. It's a part of, if you're a senator, being out there and not even hearing, just being.
Well, and just being, but also maybe grappling with a couple issues. I've covered this on my new show, Next Paths. I mean, there's an awful lot of places along Connecticut highways where you just can't walk. I mean, the roadway kind of stops.
Ball in town are among them.
There's a sidewalk some places, not sidewalk some places. I mean, does a politician actually get a different view of his state when he goes and does this?
Oh, I think anybody would, although I have to gently push back at Danny when he said this isn't a media event. And then he said, you know, he only called me. Yeah, columnist for the state's largest paper. Okay, that's not a media event because there weren't three TV crews trailing. But anyway, no, I think, you know, look, one of the things you teach young reporters is don't take the same route to work every day. Just wander around. I love campaign season because it gets me out of the Capitol. I see things. I talk to people I don't normally see. It helps me as a reporter. I'm sure this helps Chris Murphy as a U.S. senator.
Suzanne, any thoughts?
I do think it's good to get out and talk to people. I think too many people are disengaged from their political leaders anymore. And so I do think it's good for him to hear. And it was interesting. I read Dan's article and I thought, you know, some of the things he's hearing about are probably things he doesn't hear about every day. So, I think it's good.
So this week, Connecticut lost one of his most beloved residents, actor and writer, and he didn't like being called a comedian. Gene Wilder died in Stamford from complications of Alzheimer's. He was 83 years old. Just time for some quick thoughts. Do you have any favorite Gene Wilder movies? Any thoughts, Suzanne, about losing this great artist?
I love Willy Wonka. I mean, who doesn't remember? I watched that recently with my kids, and it's, you know, it translates across the ages. It's such a great movie.
It does, but didn't you find it scary too? I mean, when I talked to him years ago, I said how much it just scared me as a child because there's some very frightening things in there. There's some weird imagery.
Very weird. I think, you know, maybe kids are desensitized to that these days. My kids weren't scared by it. They loved it. They loved it. It's a great movie.
I modeled my parenting style on his performance as Willy Wonka. Not the Johnny Depp one, which truly was creepy.
Yeah.
And which he said he wouldn't watch. He told me he wouldn't watch Johnny Depp movie. He didn't like what he'd done with the character.
Yeah. I mean, Wilder was just phenomenal. Young Frankenstein, I think, is the best comedy ever made. And Wilder just had that great mix of neuroses. And, well, you can go on and on.
Danny, yeah, quick thought?
I like the Mel Brooks stuff, Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles, the best. I would say that Gene Wilder, as he said in his interview with Terry Gross yesterday, a Jewish guy doing humor is not necessarily doing Jewish humor. And he taught the world that it's not a sort of a caricature. It's individual humor and, in his case, a different style.
I have to say, I could talk about it for a long time about how influential he was to me, including the fact that Blazing Saddles was the first movie I uncomfortably watched with my parents on the couch, not sure what jokes I could laugh at. But he taught me a lesson, too, I will say. When I interviewed him 8 years ago by phone, I put on my interviewer's hat thinking that he'd want to talk about some of the new stuff he was doing. And that he wouldn't want to talk about movies he made 40 years ago. But that's all he wanted to talk about. He opened up about Mel Brooks and about Richard Pryor and about the love of his life, Gilda Radner. I learned then that sometimes the things that we love most about an artist are the things that they love the most, too. So rest in peace, Gene Wilder, and thank you for all the movies and all the times that you gave us. Thanks to Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Dan Haar from the Hartford Courant. You can join us next week in the Wheelhouse. Lucy's back tomorrow on Where We Live.